It's really difficult at this point in history because there's no sort of fully agreed upon protocol for doing this. If you knew about a vulnerability and didn't exploit it, but still refused to hand it over unless you were given a payment, then that's probably ethically still okay. You have exposed that you think there's a vulnerability, but then again, Project might think that you don't know what you're talking about.
Scraping Bits is brought to you by the following sponsors. MEV Protocol. Maximize your ETH staking value with MEV ETH. Exclusively on MEV.io. And Composable. Execute any intent on any chain, coming soon to Mantis.app. That's MANTIS.APP. And Fastlane Labs, the only MEV, an intent-centric team that has a daily deodorant application rate of over 68%. GM, GM, everyone. My name is Degachi, the host of Scraping Bits. And today I'm with 100 Proof, a fellow Australian and a very good friend of mine. So happy to have you on, man. How's it going?
Good, mate. How are you going?
Yeah, not too bad. Just so much work, grinding as usual, trying to keep on top of things, but ultimately getting there. Just for some context, for the people that don't know you, who are you and what do you do?
Okay, I just call myself an auditor and a bounty hunter or a white hat hacker. Started in the space in March 2022. Off doing some CTFs and then did some Code Arena. And then after that, switched over pretty much full time to bounty hunting.
And I think you have quite an interesting story. Even though you started in 2022, you were working at, you know, a security firm, Oak Security, with someone I interviewed previously, Jackson, but you had a different point of view, is what I've been told, and you kind of took the self-auditing route after a bit of time there. Is that right?
Yeah, so I actually started at Oak Security in, I think it was September 2022, and the story of starting there is that I didn't feel I was making enough consistent income on Code Arena, so I applied for a traditional auditing firm, which was Oak Security. And I had a week off before the first audit. And that's actually when I found my first bounty. And that one really was dumb luck. That was with Notional Finance. And it really was dumb luck. I hadn't even got to the stage where I was really digging into the code. I was merely setting up a testing environment in Foundry and decided to try just one of the simplest workflows I could, and found that I got a bit more money out than I put in when I flash loaned and put some money in, and just went through this simple workflow of buying some N tokens and then redeeming them. And I was just lucky enough to find a bug that was there, which others had missed, mainly because the contract hadn't been in this weird state until that point in time. And I was just the first one who'd actually tried that workflow when the contract was in this weird but valid state. So I was just lucky. And then I guess once I'd done that first audit with Oak Security, that was an interesting time for me because I'd found this bounty and payment was on the way, and I was still obliged to do this audit with Oak Security because I'd agreed to do it. It was kind of a weird time because I was, you know, there was a lot more money coming from the bounty in than was coming in from the audit, but it was fun. I still had a good time doing that audit. And I think it was after that that I decided, well, I probably should switch over to bounty hunting because it's suits my temperament better and it's more lucrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely a different kind of game, and it takes a different kind of skill set as well because, you know, you only have a certain amount of time. This was with Code 4, right, that you found that initial bug? The one you had dumb luck on, so you basically found that on Code 4, right?
No. So there had been a couple of Notional contests on Code Arena, and I'd done one of them, but it was in a different part of the code base. And the reason I looked at Notional out in the wild was because I was somewhat familiar with the code base. And I had a week off before doing this audit with Oak Security. So I just decided I'd see if I could find something. I found it by dumb luck.
Okay, yeah. So it just made sense that, you know, you just made this whole entire audit timeline. You made all that money in, you know, a couple of seconds or minutes or however long it took. But you still got to, you know, do this audit that's not even going to pay as well. And that was kind of a pivotal moment in time for money, I assume.
That's right. I mean, it's clear that the ROI is better on bounty hunting.
Yeah, I agree. I've also done the same thing. Never really liked to work for people just because I think if you develop the skills in, you know, a different kind of field or whatever field you want, if you focus it on yourself, like just research and build those skills, spending 100% time on that with, like, you know, accelerated, basically, instead of part-time learning while doing something else you may not really care about just for the money to keep afloat, you could really get ahead if you focus. And it's kind of a great trade-off in terms of time, because you're learning a skill that can eventually, hopefully, you know, make up all that salary money once you, you know, master it or get to a competent level where you can create, you know, a startup or a tool that someone wants or fix a problem that someone's having. And if it's really a good solution for that problem, something that's really, you know, hand under the rock, I'm going to lift the rock for you type scenario, then, you know, all that time you spend is really worth it in the long run. And that's kind of how I've seen it. And I think it's, you know, really shown when you're comparing, you know, audits, you know, with a team versus bounty hunting, because it's really a skill kind of thing at that point and not really set income for, you know, results, whether it's good or bad.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with a lot of what you just said there. I think also that one interesting thing is that I think people don't actually do their best work when they're not doing it for themselves. And you look through history at a bunch of different scientists that made breakthroughs or, you know, entrepreneurs that made great things. And you'll usually find that they have somewhat of a disagreeable or a sort of independent kind of, maybe disagreeable isn't the right word, but they have a very independent kind of mindset. And you'll tend to find that they got in trouble at multiple times throughout their life because they actively sort of disobeyed and didn't do things that they were told to do and instead worked on their own thing. And that turned out to be, for them, their strength. And for me personally, I unfortunately have quite an agreeable personality. And so the only way that I found to get free and not work on things that other people do, excuse me, is to basically not get paid for it. As soon as I'm not actually being paid for something by another person, that actually makes me feel free and like I can work on my own thing. And I guess that's really why competitive auditing and bounty hunting just works so well for me, because no one cares if I don't do it. But if I do it, there's a chance that I might win big.
Yeah, I agree with that. And just to like add on top of that, I have like this personality where if I'm, you know, working for someone or with someone, I have this obligation in my mind where I have to put 100% effort, otherwise I'm letting them down. Whereas if I, you know, do it solo, I can really work on the thing that I really enjoy and I don't want to let myself down, which really compels me to, you know, try my hardest and be on the, set up my schedule so I'm most optimal, going down the right pathway, thinking of what's absolutely necessary and what's in, you know, a high priority to get to that next level. Whereas if I'm working with someone, unless I'm getting, you know, experience, I don't think it's really a good trade-off for just money for time. Because if you really think about it, you can develop something that will generate a lot of money if you just spend the time working on those skills. But obviously the scenarios where you can work with someone and develop experience and skills, but I think eventually you hit a cap on that. You either get to the point of being on the same level of those around you because you're in that environment and you are really who you are, who you spend the most time around. Like even you can hang out with millionaires, right? You'll eventually become a millionaire. If you're really spending that much time around them, it's just going to rub off on you. The same goes with, you know, spending time with people that are not really doing anything, just, you know, lazing around. So it's really important to stick around that. But it's obviously really good to leverage that in the early days and build those skills that you can initially, you know, leverage and level up from after. I think it's just more of a determining when the trade-off isn't really making sense. And if you have like enough money and, you know, experience and passion to follow something else, I think at least the end goal for me is to make passive income where I can just live my life how I want it. And the way I can just research as much as possible on the things I enjoy, which sounds like it's similar to you.
That's my ultimate goal, yeah. I think I've mentioned this in previous podcasts, is I'm interested in software correctness and making a bit of a dent in that problem. And so this is a great way to fund that research. I'm kind of like to think of myself as a the goal is to become something like 19th century landed gentry that did all the scientific discoveries. I feel that some of the best discoveries were actually made during that age when you didn't actually have to write away for grants and research programs that had a defined end goal. It was more curiosity driven. So that's kind of what I'm aiming for, is to be able to collaborate with who I want, stop working on something if I think it's a dead end, and work on things which maybe no one else believes in but me.
Yeah, and I think it's usually those things that people don't really believe in are the most important. Nobody believed that humans could fly when there wasn't airplanes, but then someone built an airplane, right? So there's always going to be doubts, but the biggest limiting factor is really belief. You can solve those beliefs from testing, you know, the unknown and exploring new things and, you know, meeting new people. It opens your eyes to what's possible, and even feedback from them. They may give you a suggestion that you should be doing this because you have a really great skill set in this, and you didn't even know you could possibly do that. For example, me, I didn't think I would ever do a technical podcast or do anything related to content on a technical level, but I just kind of did it one day and it worked so far. So it's really about that belief. Yeah, it's crazy. So I think anybody can really do anything if they set their mind to it. It's really just stop doubting yourself and go try it. And I think that's a really big thing, is just trial and error. You never know until you hit a wall, then you can kind of think of solutions from that.
Yeah, absolutely. The biggest thing holding most people back seems to be their belief in themselves or what they think they're capable of. And I very much feel the same way as you, that you just need to go out there and try things and see how you go. But many people don't even get to that stage of actually committing themselves to a path like that, or even trying. Yeah. And yeah, you can waste half a lifetime being stuck in that state. The earlier you realize that you actually can do stuff and that it's worth giving things a go, the better, in my opinion.
You really just got to experiment and, you know, go as hard as possible. Like, what's the point of doing something if you're not going to do it 100%, right? Like, there's always going to be someone else doing it 100%. Why waste that time? Just do something that you're really passionate about and just experiment with stuff until you get to that point, I think. But I guess it's all what you desire in the long term. And anyway, to basically fund this, you know, this research-driven mindset and doing what you want, you've been doing auditing, right? And it's post-deployment, not the pre-deployment. What do you think is the main differences between the two that really determine success in both fields?
Comparing auditing and bounty hunting, that is?
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, I'd like to get more clear on what the distinction between pre-deployment and post-deployment is in this setting. I think you're the only person I've met that uses that particular term. I like the term personally, but I just wanted to get a bit more clear on what it meant for you.
Yeah. So pre-deployment is basically, you know, code base before deployment. There's no initialized state, but you may have tests or documentation to really tell you what the initialized state should be. But for example, Uniswap, without, you know, the liquidity in the pools, it's not initialized, so it's just empty, right?
Okay. I see what you meant now.
Yeah.
And then bounty hunting works on post-deployed code and auditing's on pre-deployed code. I don't know why I didn't realize that just from the term, but it's good. We got clear on that. Yeah, so it does lead to some differences between the two. Now let's think about this. So pre-deployment, there's obviously no value locked up in the contracts, and so we can't be talking about, you know, economic damage except in an abstract way. And so that's probably one of the reasons why auditing only has a sort of fixed reward. It's because the project wants to pay a certain amount to get it audited, hopefully not too much, and you can only get a portion of whatever they're willing to pay at that point. And they haven't got anything at risk either, so it's really money that's just coming from their budget. Whereas when it's a bounty, then you're actually actively protecting something that has quite substantial TVL in some cases. And then in that case, making the bounty proportional to that TVL makes a lot of sense. You're providing an incentive, and that incentive goes up as your project becomes more and more popular. So I guess that'd be the explanation for the different economic rewards between the two. The problem, I guess, with bounty hunting is that all the low-hanging fruit is most likely gone by that stage, because a good project will have already been audited several times. And the easy-to-find security vulnerabilities will hopefully be gone. I don't think I've really heard about someone putting a bounty out on a project that hasn't been audited. Those are projects that won't audit their code, but then they typically won't even have a bounty on it. So that's usually the situation there. So that's, I'm just talking about the economic rewards for those for the two different kinds of things at this point. But I guess you were also interested in what are the different strategies you might employ between auditing and bounty hunting?
Yeah, because obviously in a post-deployment state, it already isn't, you know, values initialized, maybe other protocols depend on it, for example, curve. And so you have like this whole game theory kind of setting where you think of the protocols out there and the dependencies and how they interact with each other. Whereas in pre-deployment, you don't really think of that. You're more looking at the business logic and not really the entire landscape of what's happening. Maybe limited. Maybe it's because it's limited to the, you know, the state. From what I can tell, if they were thinking of this kind of stuff, it would be addressed in, you know, audits, right? By teams, public contests, but it's not. And that's why, you know, there's hacks going on post-deployment on mainnet. So how do you kind of, what's your process really at the most granular level to finding something that's, you know, complex that can, you know, withdraw money or break the system, something like that?
Yeah. Well, that's a really good point that smart contracts that have been deployed exist in an ecosystem, and a vulnerability in a dependency could cause that smart contract to be vulnerable. But so far, I actually haven't found any exploits where I've used a vulnerability in a dependency to find an exploit in a particular smart contract. Although I do hope to do that in the future, and I think that's would be a very fruitful place to find really epic hacks, actually. I think one of the interesting that I thought about something else while you were asking your question, which was that one of the interesting things about deployed smart contracts is that they can get into states which can be quite far from what would be considered a normal state. And to explain this point, I'll kind of explain why the IT advice of turning your computer on and off again tends to work. This is something that people always laugh about and think is a bit absurd, but it's actually a good reason why turning your computer on and off again actually tends to solve a lot of problems. And that's because your computer can get into a ridiculous number of states. Like, it's way more than the number of atoms in the observable universe. Like, you turn on your computer, and with all the different software that's on it interacting in all these different ways, your computer can get into a state that no other computer's ever been in before very, very easily. And this turning the computer on and off again will basically take you back to the beginning of the boot up process. And you can imagine this like going into a forest down some path, and you're taking all these branching pathways. Some of those pathways are well trodden and some of them are not so well trodden. And what tends to happen is when you boot your computer again, you're back at the beginning of that pathway going down the well-trodden pathways, and therefore you're likely to tread the pathways where the bugs aren't. But it's very easy to sort of go off eventually after some time into some state where the computer just gets into some state where it needs to be rebooted. And I think the same holds for smart contracts, that ones that have been around for a few years may well be in some state that just wasn't tested for in their test suite, because try as you might, writing tests can never prove the absence of bugs. It can actually only prove the presence of bugs. The only way you can prove the absence of bugs is by doing mathematical proof and then doing some kind of a proof that says no matter what the input is for this, it'll come out with the right answer. But when you're doing tests, you always have to use concrete values. And you can randomize that and fuzz and all that sort of stuff, but you're still only covering a vanishingly small part of the state space that's possible. Like, you think about how big a UINT2 is. That's 2^256. And that is an enormous number. And so if you were just even trying to test PRB maths add function exhaustively, you'd be running that well beyond the age of the universe. But you could possibly prove it mathematically. And I think that's probably what PRB math did. You know, they just looked into the implementation of how adding's done in Solidity and then went, yeah, this thing's safe. they probably just did an informal proof, but you can actually prove that sort of thing. But yeah, for bigger programs, testing is, it's never going to prove, like I said, the absence of bugs. And so for these smart contracts that have been around for a while on the blockchain, yeah, there's a good opportunity to see if they're in some kind of weird state that wasn't covered by the test suite. And that's actually what happened with my Notional Finance bug. It was just in a weird state that wasn't tested for. Ah, yeah, it's been a while since I did it, but I'll try and remember the details of it. So they have this notion of Fcash, and you can have negative Fcash or positive Fcash, and this represents whether you've sent out a loan or given out a loan. It's a fixed rate loan which becomes due, the payments become due at a particular date. And they, I have actually forgotten the details of it, unfortunately, but there's maturity dates of 3 months, 6 months, and a year, which are standard maturity dates for this Fcash. But there was something called idiosyncratic Fcash, which meant that there could be a state in which some of these things became mature at 9 months, and you were just supposed to wait until that reached the 1 year mark until you did something with it.
Yeah. So I guess like anything, it's really difficult to, you know, even think about every single context this could be in. And the only way to really do that is with something like fuzzing in a practical setting. But even then, to test a gigantic system, you know, with, let's say, a dynamic array of structs with UINT256s, you know, just like these large values, addresses, etc., it would take so much time to calculate every single state. And so obviously there's stuff missing, and that's where all the hacks really come from. You've got to think of just game theory of what's actually possible. And the only way you can really understand that is by understanding, the only way you can really think of these states is by understanding the grand kind of scheme of the whole ecosystem's context. What are the main kind of protocols out there, and how can they influence this contract? Because you're not really going to think about, you know, a small little DAO and another small DAO interacting. Maybe they're just too unique, like a MasterChef and a liquidation platform. I mean, they could very well interact with each other if, you know, the dependencies are there, but it's more often than not these really big primitives like Compound, Aave, Curve. And so if you really think about it, in this generalized sense, this is where all the hacks come from, or they come from just within. And so you can really think of like a context where you're testing against all these different kind of, I guess, categories of protocols, like liquidations, you know, flash loans, liquidity pools as well, and oracles. And these are kind of the main things in like game theory kind of sense. Obviously, there's more niche things where, you know, maybe they have like special vaults for a specific token at a specific time. You can do stuff there, but that gets more like intricate and very hard to determine. Well, the overall things, you can think of states like, okay, if I borrow this, use it in this contract, what happens if there's a, you know, a lot of money involved, or at this certain date with this address, or maybe I hold this balance or send a balance to it before. It's like all these different actors and pre-transaction states that could ultimately impact the inner context and state to kind of, you know, you can kind of manipulate it as well. For example, if something that, let's say, you know, uses the balance of function in its own contract sense, like how much ether does the contract hold, you can really just send ether to it, right? If it has a receive function, and then you can kind of manipulate it in its own way, or it requires, you know, the dot total supply of token X, you can just send it. Well, there's nothing stopping that. So it is really just, you know, a minefield, and you're trying to find the mines, but that in itself is quite hard. And I think that's where the most elites get their edge, is thinking of this kind of game theory stuff, from what I've experienced. And
absolutely. I was having a conversation while at the DeFi Security Summit, and we were thinking about that situation where USDC depegged to 86 cents for like 6 hours.
Yeah.
And we were discussing the fact that there must have been so many protocols out there that would have been vulnerable during that window, and that none of them really got exploited, but there must have been so many that would have assumed USDC is always going to be worth $1. And then what's interesting is that no one would have thought USDC would depeg, but it did, right? And if you had submitted a vulnerability on a bug bounty platform to any number of protocols and said, your protocol is vulnerable if USDC ever depegs, there's no way they would have paid that money out, except it did actually happen. And there almost certainly were vulnerable protocols that just didn't happen to get hacked during that period of time. And this is the kind of like whole system security that we're going to have to worry about more and more into the future. And it's actually, unfortunately, one of those areas where black hats absolutely have the edge, because we're still at this sort of stage where we have to prove to human beings that our bounties are worth paying out as white hats. You know, this is why I'm actually thinking, this is why I'm thinking that we're really going to have to move to something like ZK proof of exploit as a way to pay white hats, because at the moment it's coming down to human judgment about whether people are getting paid or not. And that's not creating the right incentive scheme for this whole system security that we need. So for instance, we had some system where if you submit a proof of exploit, you automatically get paid. That probably would be a better situation.
Oh, yeah.
For it's kind of a complex white hats. Yeah.
Yeah. If someone figures that out, I mean, you've just disincentivized kind of black hatting if it's obviously got the right payout. But yeah, that like USDC or the stablecoin DPEG. Oh, just imagine like someone running an automated tool during that time. Oh my God. Just the amount of like dependencies, you know, now vulnerable. It's just ridiculous. It's like almost everything relies on this. Like you could easily do, you know, stablecoin arbitrage or, you know, something relies on that as a peg. For example, like a liquidator or something. Like it's just instantly gone. Right. So like everything is now vulnerable. It's just surreal to think of that. And yeah, even then, to capitalize on that, you would have to actually exploit it, right? And be like, oh, by the way, here you go, here's the funds. Otherwise they'll be like, oh yeah, we'll just wait, which is ultimately what happened.
It's probably just not adequate going into the future. You know, if we really want DeFi to succeed, then we need to find some way to actually secure the whole system. And then I think the difficult thing is that each of these protocols, you could analyze them in isolation and maybe find that they were secure given certain assumptions, but those certain assumptions might not end up being true. It's a thorny problem, that one.
Yeah, like you're going to need some system to constantly analyze, you know, basically state changes in the broad context, but even that is quite difficult because it's stateful, and stateful is, I mean, you're basically gonna have to put like a monitoring system on every single contract to be able to do that, or have a mapping of what relates to each other. Something of that. And then you even have to scan every single block of every transaction, see what state changes. And then through that, you would have to fuzz basically the contracts relating to it. I think that's the ultimate, like, only way really to cover everything. Yeah. But that is insanely computational heavy. It's a big problem. And I don't think it's ever going to go away.
As a strategy, I've actually been thinking about this just during this interview. Might be some protocols that you could actually convince to pay you some kind of a bounty if you found that their system was vulnerable to a dependency going into a bad state, like USDC depegging, for instance. Then maybe that's a fruitful path for some bounty hunters to try. It's very speculative, though, because it's probably outside the strict terms and conditions of the bug bounty programs that are out there. But it still might be a good way to actually be working in a territory that nobody else is working in. Because I always think the advice of, like, don't compete is actually a good one. You can either compete with a whole bunch of other people and then get extremely good, or you can go out into sort of virgin territory and be just kind of middling good, but creative and do quite well. And I think that's a reasonable strategy.
Mm-hmm. I think during your time as like a bug hunter as well, how do you really like choose which protocols to really look into? Because obviously there's a vast selection, and I guess you could specialize in like a category, for example, you know, borrowing and lending platforms, or I guess back in the day when yield farming was really popping off, you could specialize in that. So are you just jumping from random project to random project, or is there kind of like something you've got an edge in, you think?
I started randomly, but it hasn't stayed random since then, so it was just curiosity driven at the beginning. I generally look for things that have large code bases, probably more than 5,000 lines of code. and I look for mathematical complexity in general, because that's something I'm not particularly scared of. But from that point on, it's mainly curiosity driven. But after a while, you suddenly realize, hang on, I actually do have an edge here just by pure chance, you know, but now I'm probably going to leverage that and receive the rewards from that leverage. But I think, you know, eventually you exhaust that, and future projects that I look at will probably be just based on curiosity once again. I think the state of like Web3 security is immature enough that that strategy is going to work fine for me. And plus, I just find it fun at this point. But I think as more security researchers come into the space, I'd probably have to think about my strategy a bit more. But fortunately, for the moment, I don't have to, and I can just have fun while I'm doing it and have it be curiosity driven.
Yeah, and I think, do you use any tools to assist you at all? Or is it all really just manual?
That's a great question. I do use Slither occasionally, and it might help give me a feel for the kinds of things that might go wrong. But, you know, it has such a high false positive rate, but I don't generally find it that useful. The main tool I use is Foundry. And I know that's just a testing framework, but I use it because it's got a great suite of cheat codes, and I can fork the state of real contracts and simulate that perfectly on my laptop. And I find that seem valuable. And then essentially I use exploratory programming as a way of learning about the system in more detail. So I'll do things like write lots of logging code, and I'll actually read from storage slots that happen to have private variables. They might not be view functions for certain things. And I'll read from the storage slots to see what they are. I'll write a special function that actually formats it all perfectly and that kind of stuff. I'll sometimes use techniques like binary search to like hone in on some edge case, just stuff I learned in computer science. And you don't need to learn it at a university, obviously, just stuff you learn as you're going along.
I agree that Foundry's like forking is definitely invaluable, and without it, well, any kind of forking mechanism like post-deployment would just be a complete nightmare, because obviously you've got to generate these proof of concepts, right? And I guess that comes into like the negotiation kind of stuff as well. So let's theoretically say you found, you know, a vulnerability in my protocol and you wanted to present it to me. You wanted to ask if, you know, like you want to hand it in, of course, that's your intention, but how do you go about doing that without, you know, exposing your leverage, which is, you know, the vulnerability, but gaining the information of, okay, are they actually going to pay me? And how does this kind of work?
It's really difficult at this point in history, actually, because there's no sort of fully agreed upon protocol for doing this. You know, there are still people out there who consider not disclosing a vulnerability as being some kind of extortion, you know, which of course I don't believe. And I think that's an outdated view, but there are still people with that outdated view. I think if you knew about a vulnerability and didn't exploit it, but still refused to hand it over unless you were given a payment, then that's probably ethically still okay. You have exposed that you think there's a vulnerability, but then again, the project might think that you don't know what you're talking about. So that's probably still okay. I've tended to err in favor of just disclosing anyway so far, mainly because that's just what I want to do. And I've just decided to eat.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm not going to get paid, because there are enough fair-minded projects out there at the moment that I still think you can make a living off it. Although that might change in the future, and the whole incentive framework might change for everyone if it turns out that most people don't end up paying out.
You also have the opportunity of exposing them if they don't pay, which, you know, tarnishes their reputation and disincentivizes them for people to actually turn it in. It'll just make a black hat turn it in, like hit it anyway, and not even like consider the turn in of a, you know, being ethical.
Yeah, so I think it's completely reasonable to publicly state that you found an exploit, that you responsibly disclosed it, and that you weren't paid. That's just information for the community to know. I don't see anything wrong with that at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's actually probably a good thing for white hats to do, because it will incentivize protocols to actually pay them for their services. If we don't have an incentive for white hats to do their work, then that just means we have black hats in the space. So overall, that's a good thing for the system if white hats get incentivized better. So, and one way to do that is to disclose the information that you weren't paid for a vulnerability that you did disclose. It's good for the health of the whole system is what I'm saying.
Yeah. And I think it's important that I think protocols don't consider that the actuality of the situation is that you're technically a black hat until you're paid. Obviously not in, it only becomes that once you exploit it yourself, but you have the opportunity.
So you're saying you're a black hat until proven white.
Yeah, basically.
Like innocent until proven guilty.
I mean, like you have the opportunity there, and then it becomes this dilemma. Like if they don't pay you, then you have the opportunity to take it. If you do get paid, obviously it's a win-win for everyone. But if they don't pay you, you have two options, basically, or three options. You leave it me, and then, you know, someone else is going to take it. They're going to black hat instead. Or you do it, or you announce it to the world. Just kind of like what I think it's Google with their 0 days is they basically find, you know, bugs in a code base, and then if they don't get a response in 90 days, they just make it public. And that like incentivizes them to basically do something about it. But then again, you can also just like give them it if you're a nice person. But I think if the bounty is big enough, I don't know if money changes people, man. So
absolutely. And I think that's the thing they need to keep in mind. So there may be some straight arrows like myself that will, I've promised myself that I will never submit any transaction to any blockchain that isn't moving my own funds. But the truth of the matter is that there is a range of different personalities out there. And if you're only incentivizing black hats, then somebody's going to do it eventually. It's not going to be me, but it's going to be somebody else. That's just the reality of the situation. And it's something that projects need to keep in mind, is that humans are humans.
Yeah, I agree. And what are the problems you've really faced while, you know, doing bug bounties during this time?
I think the worst thing that's happened to me so far, and it's not particularly bad, it's just people disagreeing with the severity of issues that I've submitted. So I don't mind telling this story. There was one for Perennial, which is a project, I guess you could call it an options or hedging platform. Anyway, you've got it like many of these platforms, has a liquidation functionality where it's in the system's best interest that if a position goes underwater, that it get liquidated straight away for the health of the system. Otherwise, there could be a shortfall in the contract overall. Right. And I found on their particular protocol that they had a view function called which was supposed to tell you whether a particular person was liquidatable or not. And unfortunately, it produced out-of-date results. Oh. So it could be the case that the person was liquidatable, but is liquidatable would return false. And so I submitted this as a vulnerability to them, and they said, no, it's fine. What has been happening instead is that people have just been forking the state of our protocol and working out through simulation whether people are liquidatable or not. And doing it that way. And it's got to the stage where some of the bots that are doing the liquidations are even better than our own protocol at doing it. And so we've had no problems with that. Mm-hmm. But my general argument was you want to have as many eyeballs checking whether things are liquidatable as possible. And that view function doesn't work. And why even have it? And so I wasn't paid a bounty for that. And I wasn't asking for it. I certainly hadn't classified it as a critical or anything, just a medium. It would have been a small payout, maybe only 5K or something like that. But that's sort of the issues I've run into, is where people might disagree with the severity of a bug you've submitted.
Mm-hmm.
That's it for me so far. I've been lucky that the bugs I've found so far have been kind of incontestable. So I can demonstrate that serious amounts of funds are at risk. And there's really hasn't been any way for the projects to disagree with that. And so they've paid out the bounties.
Yeah, I think if I were to do bug bounties, I would definitely only go for vault criticals because it's inarguable and it's the most impact.
There's 100%. That's my strategy if I have one.
Yeah. Like, I don't care about their protocol at all. I care about the money in it. And can I take that, or can I stop someone else from taking it, is the ultimate goal. Because why would I care about someone's protocol? It doesn't help me in any way. Sure, it helps the ecosystem, but as an auditor, It really depends on your goals, but me personally, if I were to be doing this, there's no reason for me to try and, you know, help them out. And in that sense, like, the whole goal is, as a bug bounty hunter, is to get the most amount of money as fast as possible. And the way you do that is through the criticals and the things that actually, there's no chance involved with it. You're getting a payout, or they're not getting the vulnerability of losing all that money, basically, unless you're obviously nice, right? So if you're doing like a medium, like searching for mediums or lows, I mean, you're leaving that work up to chance. Or maybe it's just something you've noticed, which is fine. But if you're like focusing on that, it doesn't really make sense, because then you're leaving it to, you know, subjective, biased developers that, as you said, like, might not agree with the situation. Whereas if it's a critical, okay, they either pay you or their reputation gets tarnished, basically. And you've got provable things as well, right? So that's
right. It's easy to assign a dollar value to a critical, whereas not easy for lows, mediums, and even highs sometimes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting what you say. There's some stats came out of Immunify where they were saying that it seems to be the case that criticals and lows get paid out the most, and mediums and highs don't. And there was a question to the community on Twitter, mm-hmm. why do you think this is so? And my answer to that was that lows are probably low enough amounts of money that it doesn't affect the protocol much if they pay them out, mm-hmm. and criticals you can't ignore. But you can always argue about the mediums and the highs.
Yeah, I mean,
that's why I think that comes out that way.
Yeah, you can always just lowball and disagree, and what they're going to do. It's not like they're losing money, right? Like, it doesn't matter too much. It doesn't really matter at all if they're not losing money. Maybe it's just something that's optional. That's how I view it. Whereas criticals are not optional. Like, something's going to happen if you don't take it.
Exactly.
Which, I mean, makes sense from a logical. Would you rather focus all your time on, you know, the game theory, hone in on that kind of sector, or are you, you know, splitting your attention with something that, you know, might not even be detrimental in any way? It's just kind of like, oh, this is kind of cool. This helps you become a better dev. I think in my point of view, the whole point of auditing is to make sure it's secure and not, I guess, improve things that are optional. Like, what is the most...
It makes sense to go for the criticals first, right? Because they're the most impactful on the community.
Exactly. And things are actually at risk. Whereas a medium, something might not be at risk, right? It might be like something at risk in, you know, 99 years, but I don't know. That's not really... I wouldn't really worry about that right now. Yeah, I mean, that's how I would view it, but I think everybody's different. And from what I've spoken, who I've spoken to, it's always look for where the money is, follow the money until you've kind of looked at everything, and then move on to the next one and follow the money there. Seems to be like the most optimal and time-efficient strategy relative to anything else. Because you're covering more ground.
Yeah, I think it's really important to... You could argue that people should be more altruistic. But the reason we live in the civilization that we do right now is because Adam Smith came up with the idea of the invisible hand of the market, and it's worked spectacularly well. You know, his argument was, actually, you're going to get a better overall outcome if you set up your society in such a way that everyone can pursue their own self-interest, but somehow it all comes together and produces a better outcome. You know, trade and specialization is, you know, the foundation of our modern society. And you can't argue that we're not, you know, as a species, more wealthy than we've ever been before. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's still poor people in the world, but there's also 8 billion people alive on planet Earth, which is something that we thought was just absolutely impossible in the past. And that's all due to the know-how that has been unlocked by living in a market economy, basically. And so if you really want the Web3 space to become secure, you need to set it up in such a way that there's adequate incentives that people, through following their own self-interest, will actually contribute to the greater good. And I think that, you know, that's essentially where we are at this point in time. And we can't complain that people aren't going to go for bounties that are low, or not go for lows and mediums, which are inconsequential. You know, of course people are going to go for the criticals. And that's as it should be. And we shouldn't complain that people aren't being altruistic enough.
I mean, give enough incentive, you can persuade anyone, I think. Everybody has a price to some degree, whether it's, you know, monetary or with something else. But I think more often than not, people, when, you know, have a whole bunch of money sit in front of them, given enough money, something's going to change. They might still think, okay, I'm not going to do this, but they'll have the thought of doing it. So something did change. And I think once you get to that stage, it's a, you know, you don't really want to test the waters. So yeah, I don't know. I think auditing is quite interesting. I'm really excited for the future of, you know, ZK auditing or automated auditing. I think manual auditing is going to die eventually, or at least not be as easy to get into. I think right now it's also very difficult because of the competition. You're going to have to really think outside the box once, you know, these tools start getting some ground and getting more sophisticated, which is inevitable. So I think it's important to also upskill while you do it. Try and hit two fields or adventure out into a new passion or something relating to it. For example, I'm very interested in, you know, writing bytecode. And then through that, I discovered automation of it. And then through automation, you know, discover, you know, reverse engineering, then fuzzing and stack analysis, kind of went down into this new pathway. And then through that, you can also, you know, go into AI or something to do with like algorithms and most efficient kind of pathways. At least that's the way I've been kind of treating my career so far. And it's worked. I've definitely dabbled in a lot of areas, but it's also future-proofing myself for when this, you know, inevitable revolution happens.
100%. I agree with almost everything you just said.
I think we are getting close to an hour, though. I don't want to take up too much more of your time. It's been a pleasure talking to you about both philosophy and auditing in general. I really hope that, you know, you start finding these very creative exploits. I want to start reading them and thinking of new algorithms, so I'm banking on your skills.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm looking forward to finding them too. I think I've just begun.
Yeah, it's a whole new kind of field, and I think it's a skill definitely that anybody can learn given enough, you know, focus, time, determination. You've got to have grit in any kind of field. In this one specifically, it's very lucrative.
Absolutely, grit is very important. Fortunately, that I just seem to have the grit for this one naturally. I've always enjoyed solving puzzles, and I've just always been that guy who can't let a puzzle go until it's finished.
Yeah, I just keep like slamming at it until it fits.
Yep.
In different angles. But yeah, thank you so much for coming on 100 Proof. I really appreciate it and the time I spent with you. Finally got to chat. For anyone wanting to come on the podcast or even suggesting, just DM me at scrapingbits on Twitter or email me at scrapingbits@gmail.com and we'll get in touch. Otherwise, thank you so much for coming on, and I hope people got some value from this and we'll listen to the future episodes.
Yeah, it was my pleasure, and I'll certainly be listening into your podcast.
Thanks so much, and everyone have a great day.